So now, let me just briefly recapitulate what we have done yesterday, because yesterday we have done the most important calculation in statistical physics. So we basically introduced, it has fallen from the sky, we introduced the von Neumann entropy, which is minus trace rho log rho, where rho is your density matrix, which describes your statistical system from a quantum mechanical point of view. And then we also considered that the system, so this is the statistical entropy, and then we also impose that the system has some, you have some restrictions on the system, namely that you actually observe that, for example, the average value of the energy is U. And so that imposes several constraints. And depending on which constraints you have, that corresponds to corresponding ensembles. And so these constraints are really my expectation value of the operator AI is given by this small AI. And we always also have that our density matrix is normalized to one. So these are the constraints which you impose in the system, on the system, and then we showed there's this beautiful principle of maximal mass. So maximal mass imposes a variational principle which you are trying to solve for your density matrix rho, and you find that the solution of the problem, of this variational problem, is rho is given by 1 over z e to the minus some lambda I ai, where this z is called partition function, and it's trace of that, so trace of e to some lambda I ai. And it's very, very important quantity. And these lambda i's are nothing else than, you know, Lagrange multipliers, which you have to introduce in order to have well-posed variational problem with the constraints. Okay, so now a specific example of this, and perhaps the simplest one, is the canonical ensemble, where you equal ensemble. Where you allow the energy to fluctuate. So the only observable AI is the Hamiltonian, and you impose that this is true. And then your partition function simplifies, and you have that rho is 1 over z e to minus beta h. Well, that is the trace of that. But by correspondence with thermodynamics, you find that this beta has to be related to the thermodynamic temperature by 1 over T. So for most of the system, it's really enough to consider canonical ensemble. For example, when you will be studying tomorrow quantum gases, it's better to deal with the grand canonical ensemble because you will have varying number of particles. But in the classical limit, it doesn't really matter which ensemble you use, and so let's use the simplest one, which is this one here. And so once you calculate rho, or in, you don't really need to calculate rho, all you need to calculate is this partition function z. And so once you do that, you can construct the free energy. So free energy which is given by minus t logarithm of z. So if I know what the partition function is, I can calculate the free energy. And this free energy will basically give you everything you need to know about the system. So in particular, you can map this free energy to the free energy in thermodynamics. And then you know that it satisfies, for example, the differential thing is minus SdT minus PdV, and then plus if you have also this term here. Okay. And so that means I can find S, I can find S to be minus dF over dt at constant B and M. I can find P B minus dF over dV at constant T and M. And you can find mu to be dF over dN at constant T and V. Okay, so this is how you calculate basically everything you want to know about the system once you know what the free energy is. So are there any questions to this? So this basically is called statistical physics machinery. And so really, given the system, given the Hamiltonian, you want to calculate a partition function. From the partition function, you calculate free energy. From free energy, you calculate everything else. And, okay, so let us demonstrate that on a simple example of an ideal gas. Of course, all this is quantum, but you can carry that to a classical description by that correspondence which I discussed yesterday. So basically, you map the density matrix to a probability density W. You map traces to some integrals over the phase space. So there's this unique correspondence, basically. So let me do an example, which will be the ideal gas. And then in your homework, you will do slightly more general thing, basically, you know, doing a first approximation to van der Waals gas. But so ideal gas, and then I have this joke. So let's consider the relativistic notation to be in d space-time dimensions. So d space-time dimensions. So in three dimensions, well, in our world, d is equal to 4. Anyway, so now you consider n basically non-interacting particles and of course they are described by their positions and by their momenta R and P. So then the Hamiltonian, classical Hamiltonian, is just sum over I PI vector square R 1 to M, and then over 2M if all of them have the same mass. Okay, so that's your Hamiltonian, and that's your problem. So now you want to find everything you know you can about the system given this Hamiltonian here. So, of course, the machinery tells you first thing you have to calculate is that you have to calculate the partition function. This doesn't work again. So Z is a trace of e to minus beta h. So now we change the trace to that integral over the phase space. So it will be an integral over the phase space, e to minus beta h. And then you have your probability. This is your probability density. And then you have your d3p1 and d3q1 and d3pm, d3qm. And then there was that normalization 1 over 2 pi h bar to 3m, and then 1 over n factorial. So that will be just some constant which is sitting here. So let's call it Km. But let's not be bothered by that at this point, because you see that, well, once I have that, in the end, I want to differentiate some things, and so the constant will really not matter. So let's set it equal to 1 for simplicity. So this is my partition function, which I have to calculate. And so if you are looking at this, and you see if I plug it here, so I have E minus beta, and then H is this guy here. So I will have always a corresponding integral in P. So I have exponential of P square, and I'm integrating over that P. So I can use, for example, the Cartesian coordinates. So I'll write PX square plus PY square plus PZ square, and then I'll have dpx, dpy, dpz, and then I can use Gaussian integration. Okay, so using Gaussian integral, so namely that if you integrate from minus infinity to infinity, dp one of them, and then you have e to minus beta p square over 2m, so that's one such integral, then if it's better just p square, you would get something like square root of pi. So now you have something more complicated, 2pi m over beta by doing the Gaussian integration. Okay, so for that I had to ask Mathematica, but now once we have that, we can use it. So our Z becomes, so this integral you have for each P, you have in total, well, you have 3 P's for each particle, and then you have n particles, so this will be, well, okay, stupid me. So we are doing it in D dimensions. So D minus 1, D minus 1, D minus 1, and D minus 1 here. Sorry for that. So then, so that is 2 pi m over beta. And now we have n particles, and each of them, we have D minus 1 integrals. And then there's a square root, so there's this factor 1/2 over here. So we are done now with the integrals over p's. So finally, we have the integrals over q's, but of course, nothing depends on q. So we can just do them. Of course, they give us infinity, but assuming that the system is finite, they give us just the volume of the system. Okay, so now we have the volume of the system 2 power n. Okay, so this is your partition function. And so we are happy because we could calculate this partition function exactly. Okay, so the second step in your machinery is once you have the partition function, you can calculate the free energy. So maybe I'll just put it a little bit higher. So now the free energy. F is minus t logarithm of z. Okay, so I can write it as two terms. So let's take a logarithm of the first one plus logarithm of the second one. So the and then multiply by minus t. So the first one just gives me minus d minus 2 over d minus 1 over 2. Then t is there, and n is there, and logarithm of that 2 pi m over beta. And I know that beta is t, so I just put it here like that. And then the other term gives me minus tm logarithm b. Okay? So that's the free energy. And now we can use this to calculate something. So for example, we would like to know what the pressure is. Okay? So for example, if you want to calculate pressure, then by that formula is minus df over dv. So pressure is p minus df over dv. at constant T and N. Okay, so now the only thing which depends on V, of course, is the second term here. So this thing gives you minus, and there's a minus here, which cancels that minus. So it gives me Tm over V. Okay, so surprise, surprise. If I introduce small v, like the specific volume, which will be capital V over N, the total volume divided by number of particles, I just have the standard form of the ideal gas law. Okay, so indeed, statistical physics sort of works because it gives you something you already know from your high school, from your nursery school, maybe. Okay, so we recovered the ideal gas law. Hallelujah. So this V is V over N. So next thing, it's actually an interesting thing. So when we calculate this pressure, and we have sort of two terms here, and one of the terms depends on temperature only, and the other one, that's the one which contributes to the pressure, depends on the volume. So now it turns out that actually, if you split this free energy into the internal energy and temperature times entropy, so if you write something like U equals to F plus TS, so you split your free energy into the internal energy and this guy here, then when we are calculating the pressure, you are taking a derivative of this guy with respect to volume. But it turns out that the internal energy of ideal gas doesn't depend on volume. Okay, so the internal energy doesn't have any contribution to the pressure. So the only thing which has contributions to the pressure for ideal gas is the entropy. Okay, this is a very interesting observation because what you are saying is that basically the pressure in ideal gas is not caused by any, you know, movements, you know, particle bumping into the wall or whatever, but rather it comes from how you can distribute these particles in the given volume of your gas. You know, so it has an entropic origin. So I will show you now that U is only a function of T. Okay, so the pressure in ideal gas comes from entropy only. Comes from S only. That means it has completely entropic origin. I think it's interesting. So anyway, so let us show that. So for this, we first need to calculate what the entropy is. So entropy. So again, using that formula, entropy is minus df over dt. At constant V and N. So now this is a little bit more complicated calculation. We have now three terms. Differentiating the first one, I get T minus 1 over 2, and then still the logarithm. And then differentiating the second one, I get 1 over T. And so the t cancel, and I have plus t minus 1 over 2. And then, and of course, I can take that logarithm out, so that's fine. And then finally, it's minus n logarithm of v. Okay, so that's your entropy. So now, really, you can calculate the internal energy from the formula over there. So U is F plus TS And so if you plug it in, so if you're looking at S, it looks, if you multiply S by T, it looks almost like F. So some terms actually cancel, and the only thing which you get, the contribution, is this one here. So what you are getting out of this is T minus 1 over 2 times N times T. Okay, so that's your internal energy. And as I was telling you 2 minutes ago, that really this internal energy entirely depends on temperature. So U is a function of T. It's not a function of volume. And in some sense, this is a characteristic of ideal gas. Also, you may recognize by this formula equipartition theorem. So basically, each degree of freedom contributes by 1/2 nT in a given temperature. So if I have T minus 1 degrees of freedom, usually people write 3/2. So yeah, so that will work if you have T equal to 4. So this is also equipartition theorem. And so we prove the fact that really U is only a function of T, and that means that really pressure comes from the entropy. So it has entropic origin for the ideal gas. Okay, are there any questions to this? Okay, so finally, what you would like to calculate is, for example, specific heats. I haven't discussed them yet. So basically, specific heat describes how much heat I have to provide to change the temperature of the substance, in some sense. And so you distinguish specific heats. You always have to, because you have something like C is like delta Q. I will just write it dT. But of course, delta Q is not a total differential. So you have to specify which path you are taking. So you have to specify the other parameters, the other functions of state, in order this to be well defined. And for this reason, people distinguish various Cs. So they can distinguish C at constant pressure, they can distinguish C at constant volume, and so on. Because delta Q is not a total differential. You have to specify which quantities are actually constant, in some sense. So in order to, so we'll calculate Cv, C at constant volume, and C at constant pressure. But for that, let me also express how this S looks like. So this S is a function of T, V, and N. But I will also need S as a function of T, P, and N in order to calculate Cp. And that can be done very easily. Just use your equation of state for the ideal gas. So S, T, P, and N, I just remove every V in terms of P, if I can, through this ideal gas law. So now looking at here, this is very simple. So the first term doesn't have V. So V minus 1 over 2 N logarithm 2 pi MT is fine. The other term doesn't have, but the last one does. So it's minus N and logarithm, and then for V, I'm just plugging that ideal gas law. So I have V is Tn over P. And so this is the entropy as a function of temperature, pressure, and N. Okay? So now why I was doing that is to calculate the specific heats. So specific heat. And so, in general, you define it as C, and then there are some things which you have to hold constant in order this to be well defined, and it's delta Q when these things are fixed over dT. So this is general specific heat, and I really need to specify that many. So if I have, if you have n degrees of freedom, you have to specify n minus 1. You have to keep n minus 1 constant things here. So in particular CV, which is delta Q over dt at constant V and n, if you want. So now for delta Q, I just use the Clausius relation, which is delta Q is TdS. So this is TdS over dt at constant V and n. Okay, so now I need S as a function of V and n, which is the first formula here. And so ds over dt, well, the only thing which depends on t is the first term. And so it gives you t minus 1 over 2, and then n. If you multiply by t. Okay, so similarly you can calculate Cp, specific heat at constant pressure, doing the same thing here. It will be T ds over dt at constant pressure and n. So I should be writing n here as well, but people don't do that. So let's just put p there. So now I'm using the other formula. And again, so now I have two terms there. But if you do the calculation, you should find out that this is t plus 1 over 2 times n. And then you are finding Meyer's law, which maybe somebody is familiar with. So it's just the ratio of Cp over Cv. And of course, if I do the ratio, then n cancels, and I get a universal number, which is a prediction, if you want, d plus 1 over d minus 1. So in four dimensions, I have 5 over 3. And that's something you might have seen somewhere. Okay, so probably you derive this, or you use that somewhere in your thermodynamic course. Okay, so this was just an example how really to use this thermodynamic machinery. You start calculating the partition function given the Hamiltonian, then you find the free energy, and then you can calculate anything you want out of that. Okay, questions?
How are we sure that we can use the Clausius relation there? Like, when saying that the process is reversible?
Yeah, yeah. From now on, we always assume it's reversible.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a good point. But yeah. Any other question? So now, of course, the ideal gas is an idealization. And in practice, you have more dense gases, or you have to go, you know, you have interactions between particles. And so this is a very interesting subject. And you can spend many lectures, actually, trying to describe interacting gases. But let me do it just very quickly. So. We want to go to something which is called van der Waals gas, because or van der Waals fluid, if you want. It's not really only gas, but it can also describe liquids. But before we go there, let me just tell you what you would need to do. What you would need to do if you want to, you know, start studying interacting gases, and so. Interacting gas and so you know that in practice the Hamiltonian is not just p squared over 2m, over 2m, but you also have some, you know, interparticle interactions, which you can usually model as two particle interactions. So so usually two particle interactions. So you put a term sum over I and j, let's say I is smaller than j so that you don't overcount, and then you put Wij, that is W is a potential between two particles sitting, you know, particle I and particle j. So now this Wij is hopefully given just by, hopefully determined only by the distance between the two particles. So it will be function of Rij, where Rij is just the magnitude of Ri minus Rj. Okay, so this is your interacting gas. And then you can start building models. What is the best interaction to describe, let's say, you know, our molecular gases which are interacting? And so there's this relatively useful model, Lennard-Jones potential, described by Lennard-Jones potential. Lennard-Jones potential. And so you model your interaction by the following potential. So Wij is some constant which you can fit for your gas, and then Rij to power 12. And then you have another constant minus B over Rij to power 6. So if you plot this, you have something like this. So this is your Wij, and I have Rij here. So if the particles get too close, they are just repelled from each other. And here, if they are sufficiently distant, they try to attract each other, and so on. So this is a reasonable model for interactions of particles. Okay, and so now you will play with this thing a little bit in your homework, and you will derive the first correction to the ideal gas law by doing some hand-wavy arguments, basically, and trying to solve the partition function for this, but not really, you know, just doing some very crude approximations. You can get something nice. But there's a systematic way how to do that, but it's a painful way. It's really lots of calculation, and so the way is called integral cluster expansion. And you start drawing diagrams like if you are in quantum field theory, and then you start doing some calculations and some perturbations, and so on. And so, very complicated technique. What you get out of that is that you get a correction to your ideal gas law. So in the same way as you introduce small v, you can introduce also small n, which is just 1 over small v. So small n is just 1 over v, or n over v here. So then this would be the ideal gas law. And so then you have the corrections. So you have 1 plus, and then the corrections are B2, and then the expansion goes in n, so n square B3, n cube B4, and so on. And so, you know, going order by order, you can construct these corrections. These coefficients B1, B2, B3, B4, they can depend in general on temperature. Okay, so these are temperature dependent. And in principle, you can get an infinite series. Of course, that's not very practical because you have to, for each gas, you have to fit the data. And to fit the gas, you need to fit, you know, the coefficients which appear in this expansion. Okay. So it's not very practical. People go to various orders of this expansion. But surprisingly, You don't have to really do that. So if you think about normal gases, which you usually encounter, this virial expansion or cluster expansion is actually not very helpful. But you can do without that by considering van der Waals equation. So van der Waals equation is something like this. It's not really a series of expansion like that, but it's a closed form of an equation of state. So this is an equation of state which you are writing down for interacting gas. So now the van der Waals equation was not derived in that way, and in fact, it can be it's very difficult to derive it. You only get an expansion, but yeah, okay. And so it's just a modification of the ideal gas law in the following way. You say that the pressure is actually not given by P, but it's something like that. So this is your old pressure, and then your V is given here, and this is your T. Okay, so this is my original P of the ideal pressure. This is my original V of the ideal gas, and it's equal to T. But now I have modification of these things, so I add two parameters which describe this van der Waals equation. And so the parameter A is positive, and it describes the attraction between the particles. And the parameter B describes really the volume, something like a volume of the particles. So volume of fluid particles. Particles. And so the equation is something, you know, you would very intuitively write down without knowing anything about the cluster expansion over there. So really what you are saying here is that, yeah, if I have attraction between the particles, then this attraction actually has to increase the pressure. So that's why you are writing this guy here and now increasing pressure by that thing here. And of course, if I'm interested in how far the particles, really the size of the particles matters. So I have to subtract the volume of the particles from the real volume, and that gives me, you know, the space in between them. And so you can very intuitively and, you know, very from a physical point of view, you can write down this equation. And that's, of course, what van der Waals did in at the end of 19th century. And so he was awarded a Nobel Prize for this in 1910, I think. And so it's just, you know. So now what is beautiful about this equation is that despite it is described by only two parameters, which you, of course, have to fit for each gas. So if you want to describe helium, helium is not a good example. If you want to describe air in this room, you just need to fit what A and B is. And once you fit that, you can do the predictions, right? So whereas this guy was an infinite series, so you needed infinite number of measurements, or you truncated the series, and it was not very accurate. This one is more accurate than that one, usually, for normal gases, with just two parameters. Okay, so. Yeah, so just these two parameters here. So now you can plot what happens. So for example, how the isotherms look like for this van der Waals equation. And you've seen that. So if I plot, I make a diagram P and V. And so if I use the ideal gas law, I have PV equals to T. So if I fix T, then I have that the pressure is it's constant over V, so it goes something like this. So this will be still true here for sufficiently high temperatures. So if temperature is sufficiently high, it's bigger than T critical temperature, then you get these ideal gas isotherms. But there is this critical temperature, because now your equation is more complicated, when actually you start developing an inflection point. So there's an inflection point here. And then below that inflection point, you have oscillatory behavior, something like that. So this is T equal to T critical, and this is below the critical temperature. Okay, so this is the behavior of isotherms when you have the van der Waals equation. So now this inflection point plays a very special role. So you see that it happens at T equal to T critical, but of course I can also read where exactly it happens here. So it's characterized by P critical, V critical, and T critical. So this, so let's call it critical point or inflection point. And it corresponds to PC, VC, and TC. So there are some fixed values of pressure, fixed value of volume, and fixed value of temperature. Okay. So now, below this, for temperatures smaller than that, something really strange happens. And so if you take really the real gas, and you start studying what happens to this gas, then you find that really the prediction, so for example, for the isotherms, you really follow these things here very nicely, much more accurately than in the cluster expansion there. But if you are below T critical, you don't. Well, actually, you sort of do, but only to a certain place. So you do for large volumes and large pressures. But if you are over here, so you keep compressing your gas, but suddenly you don't go up here, but rather you take a shortcut and go like that. So for real gas, you go like that. Instead of going up and down, you go here, and then you continue going here. So this part of the isotherm is fine, that part of the isotherm is fine, but this oscillatory behavior is not. Okay, and so this was noticed for real substances. So what is actually really happening here is that you are changing the phase. So here you have gas, and here you have liquid. And so this line here, which happens at constant pressure, actually corresponds to the change of phase. So you are changing gas to liquid, so you are condensating gas to liquid, or if you go the other way around, you are evaporating your liquid to form gas. Okay, so this was experimentally measured. So now, of course, the question is, can you describe this mathematically? And so how to go really from this unphysical behavior of van der Waals equation to the physical one where you start changing the phases. And so Maxwell, the famous Maxwell from Maxwell equations, actually was also interested in thermodynamics. And he came up with a great law. He's saying, well, in order to find where this phase transition really happens, at which pressure P0 with this phase transition really happens, you just employ my law, equal area law, so that this guy here, the area here, is the same as that area over here. Okay, and that gives you the pressure where it's where it happens. So if I denote the volume, specific volume of the liquid here, and I denote this volume of the gas here, then you want to express that the areas have to be equal, and then you just find that P0 V gas minus V liquid is equal to the integral from V liquid V gas of PdV. So if I follow this guy here up and down, I add here the same thing as I subtract, so it must be equal to this rectangle here. And that's precisely what Maxwell's equal area law says. Okay, so this thing is Maxwell's equal area law. Or if you think about it, you can write the same expression, not in terms of this P0 VGM, but you can write it as a circular integral. If you are going from here, so I have a pass, well, okay, it doesn't matter. I go like this, and then I go like that, and then I go like that, and I go and return back here. So then you find that the area, if you are looking, if you twist the diagram on its side, must be equal to 0. So in other words, this must be true. VP equals to 0. And that's another formulation of this Maxwell's equal area law. And you will prove it in tomorrow's tutorial. So don't worry, you will see it again. So really this was a beautiful thing. So because from van der Waals equation, once you have the van der Waals equation, you can sort of, if you accept this Maxwell equal area law, you can sort of start studying phase transitions. Theoretically, of course, phase transitions were observed before, but now you could really study them by doing some math. And using van der Waals equation and plus Maxwell's equal area law, you can do that now. And so that was a historically huge thing to do. Questions? So let me make a few remarks about more generally how we describe phase transitions in thermodynamics. So phase transitions So more generally, the thing which actually describes the best phase, how you like to study phase transitions in thermodynamics is that you study one of the thermodynamic potentials, and because the phase transitions usually happen, you fix the system, like you're fixing temperature and be fixing pressure or something like that. So the corresponding potential is the Gibbs free energy. So study Gibbs free energy. If you consider the surface, so you have G and you have T and P. You have G, you have T and P. Of course, this swipes some hypersurface in this three-dimensional thing. So G is a function of T and P, and it swipes that hypersurface. So if there are no phase transitions, meaning you have just one phase and everything is, then this hypersurface is nice and smooth. Okay, so. This is the G, the function of T and P surface. So, if you have the phase, then this thing is, nice and smooth. However, if you have a phase transition, namely the first order phase transition, then what happens is that the hypersurfaces somehow, so this thing is still smooth, but it may sort of, at one point it may go up and form another surface, and then it may go down again, and so it will intersect the original one. So then I have something like this, an intersection, and they intersect in a line. And so that's, typically two surfaces in 3D space, they intersect in line. So a phase transition corresponds to an intersection. Intersection of these surfaces in a line, typically. So now you may want to find out which of these phases, so let's say this hypersurface, this is a very bad picture, I apologize, let me do it again. So I have one surface here, and that corresponds to one phase, so that's phase one. And then you have another surface, which goes like this, and this is in my GTP plane, and that's phase two. And so they intersect here, so that will correspond to your phase transition. And so to find which phase actually will dominate is that you are, because you are still in thermodynamic equilibrium, you want to minimize the corresponding potential. So the phase which has lower Gibbs free energy is the stable one. So in this case, this guy will be stable. So let's say this is my temperature. So for temperatures smaller than that, the phase two will be stable one and will realize. So for example, that will be the liquid. And then for temperatures bigger than that, this one will be stable. So stable phase corresponds to the global minimum, if you want, of the Gibbs free energy. Stable phase corresponds to global minimum. So of course that doesn't mean that, so really, let's say I'm moving on this stable phase here, so I'm moving on this surface here, and so now I cross this line, and I can sort of decide, am I continuing this way, or am I going that way in the stable phase? And it may happen that actually for some time, you can continue on the unstable phase, and then you would be a metastable state. So you have, for example, how is it called? It's like overcooled water. So you can put a water in the fridge, and it can, let's say, have a temperature minus one, but it's still water. It's not ice because it didn't start actually crystallizing, basically. But then if you shake it a little bit, then it freezes immediately. So that means, as that freeze out happens, is that you were on this unstable phase, but when you shook it, actually it jumped to the stable one from the metastable one. That's precisely what's happening with these surfaces. Okay, so now you can start. So really, phase transitions in thermodynamics are all about Gibbs free energy. Are all about finding the global minimum of the Gibbs free energy in this plane. So now you can distinguish various types of phase transitions. So types of phase transitions. And so basically what you are interested in is how the global minimum actually behaves. So G minimum, how it behaves. And so if it is continuous, but its derivatives are not continuous, then you talk about first order phase transition. First order phase transition. So this would be precisely an example here. So if I really go like this, then I go like that. So the global minimum is continuous. Here it is continuous as it crosses the line, but the derivative is obviously not. So that will be an example of first order phase transition. If it's continuous and let's say So the G minimum is continuous, and let's say G prime is also continuous, whatever that means. So also the derivatives are continuous, but G double prime is not. Then you talk about second order phase transition. And similarly for higher order phase transitions. So third order, you would have continuous G, G prime, and G double prime, but not G, G three derivatives, okay? And so on higher orders. So usually, the most important difference is really whether you are first order or higher order. If you are first order, well, you are first order. If you are second order and higher, then people call that continuous phase transition. Sometimes. Continuous. So I have that graph. Let me just draw it here, but it's obvious. So your first order look like something like I have G, and this may be my parameter, for example, T, and I'm plotting, let's say, P equal to constant things, and first order will be the derivatives. Well, the G is continuous, but the derivatives are not, so G prime, and let's say T, so then I have this thing, and there's a jump in the first derivatives. In the second order, so G is continuous, so nothing here really happens. G prime is continuous, but G double prime is not. It's not. Okay, so that will be typical pictures you are getting if you are classifying phase transitions using the Gibbs free energy. So once you have studied the Gibbs free energy, you can actually plot also the phase diagrams. Really, you know, what happens. So in the parameter space, let's say in the parameter space of pressures and temperatures, when do you have phase one, when do you have phase two, and so on. So let me do it. So let me do it very concretely for the van der Waals gas. So if you take the van der Waals thing, so van der Waals again, then what you find is that your Gibbs free energy looks like this. So this is your Gibbs, and this is your temperature. And then I'll be plotting isobars, so P equal to constant things. So then you find that this Gibbs free energy is nice and smooth for P bigger than P critical, but it develops a kink at P critical. Of course, this kink will correspond to our critical point. And then below, for pressure smaller than P critical, it has this very nice behavior like that. Okay, so this very nice behavior like that, because if you do a three-dimensional picture, it looks like a tail of a swallow. So this thing is called swallowtail. Okay. It's probably swallowtail. So the question is whether it's African or the other one. Okay, anyway, so we have this swallowtail. And if you have, so this is P smaller than PC, and then this is getting even bigger for pressures even smaller than that. So that would be another swallowtail and so on. And it's really, if you plot, you can plot the Gibbsville energy for the van der Waals equation, then you will get a nice swallow out of that, a swallowtail. Okay. So anyway, so now this is the behavior of the Gibbsville energy for van der Waals. So now we can plot the phase diagram. Phase diagram. And so you are interested in really when in the parameter space, so in our case it will be the pressure temperature diagram, because that's what your Gibbs function is function of. And so in certain regions of this space, there'll be phase one, which will be liquid, and in certain regions it will be phase two, which is the gas thing. So how do I know where is what? Well, I can read these things precisely. So I know that, you know, I plot this thing here for a fixed pressure, P critical, and it gives me the corresponding temperature here. Okay? So that's where I start distinguishing two phases. For this guy, there is just one phase. For this guy, something strange starts happening. But for this guy, I want to minimize the Gibbs free energy. So I want to be here, but I don't want to continue this way. I want to go that way. So I want to minimize the Gibbs free energy here and there. So there'll be a first order phase transition here at this point. Okay. So this point will give me some temperature and some pressure. So it's the P critical here and T critical here. So P critical and T critical, and that's my critical point. And then I can read, you know, for this pressure, which is smaller than P critical, and so I have a stupid picture. It should be rather like that. It should be a little bit to the left of that. So it should be for small t. Okay, so then I read for this small for this P smaller than P critical, I read where this point is. And it will be, for example, here. And then I read for another swallowtail here. And it will be here. And in the end, I can plot the line, which will be precisely the line where one phase meets another phase. And it terminates at a critical point. Okay? There's a critical point here. So now, here there is phase one. Corresponds to this guy. This guy corresponds to phase two. So phase one will be, in our case, will be liquid. And phase two, in our case, is gas. Okay, so, and this thing, which separates the two phases, is called coexistence line. So if I want to change liquid to gas, I can go this way here. Of course, when I'm crossing the coexistence line, I'm undergoing the phase transition from one phase to another one. Okay. Because it's first order phase transition, actually you need to provide some latent heat. So if you need to boil water in order to evaporate it, or the water extracts heat from the surroundings. So first order phase transition, you need some latent heat to go from one phase to another here. Okay. But you see that above, you know, PC and TC, you don't really distinguish a liquid from gas because the line doesn't continue. So actually, you have sort of one phase, you know, above this critical point. So what it means is actually that you can sort of cheat on phase transitions. So if you start with a liquid here, And you start with a gas here. Yes, you can go this way, and you know decide to undergo a phase transition, and you know go from one point to another point in your phase diagram. But of course, you can also go around this, and you don't undergo a phase transition in this path. So there is really no clear distinction in this picture between liquid and gas, really. So you can always cheat on that, and you can always go around if you want to. So no clear distinction between liquid and gas. Okay, so now you can study various properties of this phase diagram. And you can, for example, study what is the slope of this coexistence line. So really, how steeply I'm going here, how steeply I'm going there, and so on. So now there's a beautiful equation which describes the slope, which again you will derive tomorrow in your tutorial, and it's called Clausius-Clapeyron equation. So slope of coexistence line is governed by this Clausius-Clapeyron equation, which reads dP over dT, coexistence. And it's just given by the difference of the entropies and difference of the volumes. So it's S, delta S over delta V, which is S of gas minus S of liquid, V of gas minus V of liquid. Okay, so, and this is called Clausius-Clapeyron equation. So really, if I want to go from here to there, the entropy of the gas will be different, and of the liquid, and as well as the volume will be different. But if I form this ratio, it precisely gives me the slope at that point of the coexistence line, in some sense. Okay. So you'll derive this in your tutorial. Interestingly, whereas this guy is really a first-order phase transition, at the critical point, something else happens, and it's a second order phase transition. So the critical point is actually second order. And second order phase transitions are really beautiful because they have some kind of universality, which we will talk about this and next week. And so and they are really easy to describe physically. So second order phase transitions are beautiful. First order, not so much. So we will concentrate mainly on these second order phase transitions. And so similarly to this guy here, you can describe the critical point by some other equations. So Clausius-Clapeyron is only for first order. This is only for first order phase transition. For the second order, an analog of that actually is called Ehrenfest equation. So Ehrenfest equation and again I'm not going to write it here, but you will derive it tomorrow in your tutorial. So for second order phase transitions you have also a description, and it's through the Ehrenfest equation. There's actually two equations. Characterizing this point somehow, you will see explicitly tomorrow. So it's something like, I'm interested in the slope here, and it's given by the difference of the entropies. I'm interested in some property here. It will be actually again, sort of like how pressure changes as you cross this point. And it's described by these Ehrenfest equations. You will see explicitly tomorrow. Okay. How much time we have? So, questions? At the same time, you can introduce critical exponents which characterize your second order phase transition. So it's not only Ehrenfest equations, but also critical exponents characterize your critical point. And we will learn what these are, in a couple of lectures. So now if you study water, you know that it has more than two phases. It's not only a vapor or liquid, but it can be ice as well. And so typically you have the normal substances in, you know, in normal temperatures. You have phase diagram like that, P and T. And then you have actually usually three phases. So you have, this is our critical point, which we just described. And this is our gas thing, and this is our liquid. But there's another first order phase transition, which goes to the solid. So you can change liquid, or you can change water to ice, and so on. So interestingly, whereas the coexistence line between liquid and gas terminates at this critical point, and you can go around, so from thermodynamic point of view, there is no really distinguishing liquid and gas, you cannot do the same thing between liquid and solid. This coexistence line actually goes all the way to infinity. So you really have to melt the crystal to form a liquid, and it has different structure. There's no way to go around. You always have to undergo the phase transition if you want to go from solid to liquid or the other way around. Okay, so this is very typical solid, liquid, gas phase transition. Okay, so the last thing, just to make it more interesting, I would like to mention re-entrant phase transitions, which I don't know if you know what they are. So re-entrant phase transition . So re-entrant means that it re-enters. Okay, something re-enters again. Okay, and so here's a definition. So definition, a system undergoes a re-entrant phase transition. Let's call it RPT, re-entrant phase transition, if a monotonic variation of any thermodynamic quantity results in two or more phase transitions so that the final state is basically macroscopically similar to the initial one, is macroscopically similar to initial. So that's a definition what you mean by a re-entrant phase transition. So now what the hell that means? So the best is actually to illustrate this on an example. And I think the first recorded example of re-entrant phase transition is really beautiful because you can do it at home. And I encourage you to do it at home. Okay, so what was observed is that in 1904, Hudson played with a mixture of nicotine and water. So if you smoke, you have an advantage. I don't encourage you to smoke, but maybe you can ask a friend. So Hudson, in 1904, so he found the corresponding diagram. So here is the temperature. And here is the percentage of nicotine in water. Okay, so more nicotine that way. Okay, and so what he observed is actually there's some very interesting phase structure. So this is now our phase diagram. So now we have T and percentage of nicotine in the mixture. So here we have P and T, but it doesn't matter. And so now you observe a bubble. Okay, so outside of that bubble, you have completely mixed homogeneous mixture. So homogeneous, so outside of this is homogeneous. Meaning you cannot really distinguish water from nicotine. They are just mixed together and they form one phase and you cannot tell separate one from another. But if you are inside the bubble, then suddenly it's not true anymore. The bubble is split into two halves. Well, not really halves, but into two pieces. So if you are in this thing here, then suddenly you have two layers. You have nicotine here, so you have layer of nicotine downstairs and water upstairs. So if I, for example, cross this line, I have something which is completely mixed and homogeneous. If I increase the temperature here, and suddenly two layers form, I have layer of water up, and I have layer of nicotine down. So people play with the beer and black beer, white beer, or similar things. So now if you cross that line, the two layers actually swap. So you have nicotine up, and then water down. Okay? But if you keep increasing the temperature, then again, the miracle ends, and the two things again mix together. Okay? So that's precisely what you mean by re-entrant phase transition. You start with something which is homogeneous and looks in certain way, then you undergo several phase transitions, and then you end up with something which is exactly the same, well, looks the same macroscopically as the something which you started with. And so this is an example of a re-entrant phase transition. Of course, you can go this way as well, and it'll be changing the percentage of nicotine. So I encourage you to do it at home if you want to, and tell me about the results. So this was the first documented observation of re-entrant phase transitions, and since then this behavior was observed for many other substances, and especially so what is happening is, so for example you have binary gas systems, you have gels, you have ferroelectrics and stuff like that. And so basically, in order this re-entrance happens, is that there must be at least two competing phenomena. And so depending on which one is winning, you have that behavior or you have that behavior. So it may happen that at some point, they want to be mixed, and then something wants to separate them, and so it's separated, but then it's not powerful anymore, and they are fixed, they are mixed again. So it's usually, there must be some competing phenomena. In order to have these various phase transitions. Okay, so interestingly, we observe these phase transitions for black holes as well. So where you actually observe a diagram, not really like that, but you have something like that, and then it sort of disappears. But you have a large black hole here, and you have a small black hole here, and they are separated by a first order phase transition. So if you are large, and so this is like a cosmological constant, and you are a large black hole here, suddenly you undergo a phase transition to be a small one, and then you undergo another one to be a large again. So is this phase transition, similar phase transitions in black hole physics, recently observed. So why don't I stop here, and we start the microscopic description of phase transitions tomorrow.